Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Senior Veterinary Nurse at Anderson Moores Veterinary Specialist, Denise Prisk. Thank you, Denise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma. Hello and welcome to the webinar. Today we're going to be looking at oxygen therapy and supplementation. All tissues need oxygen in order to function. Decreased oxygen concentration in arterial blood can be caused by a variety of factors, including disease, trauma, and anaesthesia. In addition, we've got anatomical variations, such as those which are seen in any brachycephalic animal, and all of these can lead to decreased oxygenation of blood and tissues. Oxygen therapy is supplementing the air breathed, which is about 21%. With oxygen which has a higher concentration, so a concentration of more than 21%. In this webinar, we're going to look at various ways in which oxygen supplementation can be accomplished. But it's also necessary to understand how and why animals become hypoxemic. So I'm going to start off with a bit of basic physiology and some recapping. So oxygen is necessary by all cells and tissues for normal homeostatic functions. And as well as the respiratory system, other systems are involved, namely the cardiovascular and the central nervous system. And these are all necessary to ensure that homeostasis is carried out. A knowledge of respiratory physiology is necessary because the respiratory system is affected by disease and illness, and that will lead to decreased ventilation and oxygenation of tissues. So external respiration is the transfer of gases between the external environment and the blood. And this occurs in the alveoli by diffusion across the pulmonary membrane. And then we have internal respiration or tissue respiration. And this is the transfer of gases between blood and the cells. And this is where oxygen is taken into the cells and carbon dioxide is removed from them. And in order for all of this to happen, there has to be a concentration gradient. So a concentration gradient is produced when the concentration of gases in the blood and the alveoli is not equal. And this gradient causes oxygen to move from the alveoli into the blood, where it then moves into the erythrocytes and combines with hemoglobin. And at that point, it becomes oxyhemoglobin. This is a reversible oxygen carrier, meaning it can carry oxygen to tissues and then release the oxygen. Carbon dioxide diffuses from the cells into the blood, where it's carried to the lungs to be exhaled. So a little recap on some terminology. Respiration is the exchange of gases. So that's the exchange really of oxygen and carbon dioxide. And as I just said, we've got external and internal respiration. And ventilation is the movement of air into and out of the lungs. In other words, breathing in and breathing out. So although the two terms respiration and ventilation are used synonymously, there is a difference. We could say that ventilation facilitates respiration, and without ventilation, then exchange of gases simply cannot occur. Other terms which are used are compliance. Compliance is the degree of stiffness, and we're usually relating this to the alveolar wall or the thoracic wall. So in other words, it's the elasticity. And atelectasis is collapse and closure of alveoli. Tidal volume is the volume of air which moves in and out of the lungs at each breath. And in dogs and cats, that's around 10 to 15 mils per kilo. It's much less in rabbits. In rabbits, the tidal volume is 4 to 6 mils per kilo. And the minute volume is the volume of air moving into and out of the lungs in each minute. So we can get that by multiplying the tidal volume by a resting respiratory rate. If you don't have a resting respiratory rate, for whatever reason, the the minute volume of dogs and cats is around 200 to 250 mils per kilo. Functional residual capacity is the air which is left in the lungs after normal expiration, and this allows gaseous diffusion to continue between breaths. And it's especially important for those species that have an expiratory pause. So the whole cycle is inspiration, expiration, expiratory pause. And the residual volume is the air which is left in the lungs after the deepest possible expiration. And it's the air that is always in the lungs as long as the animal is alive, and it's there to maintain a negative pressure. Anatomic dead space, or dead space air, is the volume of air which is breathed in, but it never reaches the alveoli, and therefore it doesn't undergo any gas exchange. So anatomically, it's the air which is in the trachea, the bronchi, and the larger bronchioles, or we could say it's the volume of the conducting airway passages. So this part of the tidal volume is the anatomic dead space ventilation. And it's different from alveolar dead space ventilation because this is the areas of the lungs which are ventilated but are poorly perfused with blood, or they're not perfused with blood, and therefore gas exchange doesn't occur in these areas. Respiratory depression will obviously compromise oxygenation, and there are various ways in which respiratory depression comes about, but largely we can have reduced functional residual capacity, alveolar collapse, or acid-base imbalance. Functional residual capacity can be reduced because of disease or the condition of the animal. So, for example, pregnant animals have reduced functional residual capacity, as do obese animals. Or it can also be human error. If you lean on an animal's chest or place a heavy instrument or tray or something on the animal's chest, then that will reduce their functional residual capacity. So, in a way, we have a little bit of control over that. Alveolar collapse can be due to disease, obesity, or any animal that is in prolonged lateral recumbency. And we're going to look at acid-base balance and why that is important in relation to respiration. So, looking at acidity, we talk of pH. pH just means per hydrogen. And acidity is a measure of the concentration of hydrogen ions. So, if you think of hydrogen ions as being acidic, then the higher the concentration of hydrogen ions, the more acidic the fluid and the lower the pH it has. The normal pH of mammalian blood is 7.35 to 7.45, and it's really important that it stays within this range to maintain normal homeostasis. So it's needed for normal enzyme activity and cellular metabolism. So acidosis is where we have a pH of less than 7.35, and alkalosis is where we have a pH of more than 7.45. And an acid is something which donates hydrogen ions in solution, and a base or an alkaline is something which accepts them. And we have the buffer, the respiratory and renal systems that deal with altered hydrogen ion concentration and ensure that the pH is stabilized, and this should happen in the healthy animal. A buffer is just something which resists a change in pH when an acid or a base is added. The respiratory system controls carbon dioxide levels, and the renal system is responsible for excreting hydrogen ions in excess and for maintaining bicarbonate levels. So, just to do a little bit of chemistry, because this is really important when we're thinking about respiration, carbonic acid is just carbon dioxide dissolved in water. So, CO2 and H2O has got a reversible equation. It means it can go both ways, and that becomes H2CO3, and that's carbonic acid. And carbonic acid can then dissociate into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. Remember, an acid gives away a hydrogen ion, so carbonic acid gives away a hydrogen ion, So this is carbonic acid, and it gives away this hydrogen ion, and you're left with one hydrogen, one carbon, and three oxygen molecules, which is bicarbonate. And bicarbonate levels are regulated by the kidney. Carbon dioxide then is eliminated from the body by the lungs during respiration. Carbon dioxide is the waste product of cellular metabolism. So if we have increased respiration, that will remove carbon dioxide and water, because remember, those two combine to form carbonic acid. And that means that if it removes it, you've got less carbonic acid, fewer hydrogen ions in the body, and so less acidity. But what is more common is when we have decreased respiration, which leads to retention of carbon dioxide and water. So those two combine, there's more carbonic acid in the body, more hydrogen ions, and more acidity. So to sum up, then we've got increased respiration means we've got less acidity, and decreased respiration, which is the more common, means we've got more acidity. And so respiratory acidosis, decreased respiration, occurs with animals which hypoventilate under general anesthesia, also if they were to be given an anesthetic overdose. Respiratory failure, maybe you'd have an animal with a ruptured diaphragm which isn't ventilating properly. Inhalation of CO2 is realistically going to happen as rebreathing when they're anaesthetized. Respiratory alkalosis is much more rare. It may occur in some conditions, pain, hypothermia, hyperventilation, stress, but this sort of hyperventilating and panting is really moving around dead space ventilation, so it is not as likely to occur. So now we're going to look at other mechanisms that are involved in the control of respiration. Starting off with neural control of respiration. Neural just means relating to the nervous system. And we've got three key physiological processes relating to neural control. So the first one is the medulla of the brain. The medulla is the medulla oblongata, the brain stem. This contains respiratory and also cardiac pacemaker centers, which are directly responsible for any increase and decrease in ventilation and cardiac frequency. And the respiratory centers are in the medulla and the pons. So this is the medulla here, this is the brain stem, and then the pons, which is this sort of pouching out area, is also part of the brain stem. The second physiological process is the Herring-Bruer reflex. This is the reflex that determines the depth of respiration, so it stops excessively deep breathing all the time. And this involves the receptors, which are found in the walls of the bronchioles, the vagus nerve, which is the 10th cranial nerve, and the respiratory centers in the brain. And then the third process is spinal nerve control, and this involves the phrenic nerves. So we have a left and right phrenic nerve, and these are spinal nerves which run from the neck to the diaphragm, the diaphragm itself, and the intercostal muscles. So all of these mechanisms are necessary for adequate breathing. And then we have humoral control of respiration. Humoral means relating to body fluids and blood gases. So as we just said about acid-base balance, increased levels of carbon dioxide, which result from slow breathing, are carried in blood as carbonic acid, and that will lead to decreased pH of plasma, also extracellular fluid and cerebrospinal fluid. When this happens, the medulla is stimulated, respiratory rate and depth increases, and that will lead to reduced carbon dioxide levels and correction of pH. And then we also have chemoreceptors. These are found in the aorta near the heart and the carotid bodies, which are at the base of the carotid arteries in the neck. And they respond to fluctuations in oxygen and carbon dioxide levels and stimulate the respiratory centers in the brain as necessary. So now we're going to look at how oxygen is actually transported in the blood. So it's carried in the blood in one of two ways. The majority, the vast majority, about 97%, is bound to hemoglobin. And then a very small amount, maybe 3%, is dissolved in the plasma. And arterial oxygen concentration is determined by the hemoglobin concentration and the ability of hemoglobin and oxygen molecules to bind. One hemoglobin molecule can carry four oxygen molecules. So if you think of a hemoglobin molecule as being a four-seater car, so here we have a hemoglobin car, if you like, and it can take four oxygen passengers. And at that point, that particular molecule is fully saturated. So oxygen saturation refers to the saturation of hemoglobin with oxygen, and that gives us our oxyhemoglobin. And this can be measured either with pulse oximetry, which is SpO2, or blood gas analysis, which is SaO2. So SpO2 is an indirect, non-invasive guide with a pulse oximeter, and SaO2 is a direct, invasive measurement whereby you need to take a sample of arterial blood. Oxygen saturation is a measure of how much oxygen the blood is carrying as a percentage of the maximum that it could carry. Therefore, whichever means you use to measure it with, it's always measured as a percentage. So your units of measurement for saturation are always going to be percentage. So if we go back to our hemoglobin cars, if you imagine that there are 100 of these hemoglobin cars here, I know I've only got 10, but if you imagine that there are 100 and we're on some strange sort of hemoglobin WI outing or something, and then in these cars, in these 100, we've got two empty seats only, then this would be said to be 98% saturated. However, I've just picked on 100 because it's as a percentage and it's an easy number to use mathematically. But remember, every single red blood cell contains several hundred million hemoglobin molecules. So that puts your pulse oximeter reading into some form of perspective. When we talk of blood gases, we're looking at the partial pressure. So PaO2 is the partial pressure or the tension of oxygen gas that's dissolved in blood. Now, because it's a pressure, then the unit of measurement here would be millimetres of mercury. To do this, we need a direct invasive measurement whereby we take a sample of arterial blood and put it through a blood gas analyzer. But because of the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve, it means that there is no direct correlation between what you see on your pulse oximeter, which is your SpO2, and PaO2, which is the result that you would get from blood gas analysis. So an SpO2 of 95%, if that was a real reading, would probably equate to a PaO2 of around 80 millimetres of mercury. And 80 millimetres of mercury is the beginning of desaturation. So really, you need to keep your SpO2 over 96%. So by far the best way to monitor oxygenation is by using blood gas analysis, and this will assess lung function. A normal lung function occurs at an arterial concentration of oxygen of more than 85 millimetres of mercury, and this would be for an animal that is breathing room air. Room air is about 21% oxygen. So when we're talking of different percentages of gas within a mixture of gases, we refer to the FiO2, and that is the fraction of inspired oxygen. And so the amount of oxygen in arterial blood, the PaO2, should be about five times the percentage that we breathe in. So an animal at room air, so this is an awake animal, breathing room air at atmospheric pressure, should have 5 times 21, which is 105 millimetres of mercury. But that same animal, which is then anaesthetized and maintained on 100% oxygen, should have 5 times 100. So its PaO2 should really be 500 millimeters of mercury. So to measure blood gas analysis, you need a sample of arterial blood, either from an arterial catheter. If you've got an art line in place, then it's easy to get, or you'd need to perform arterial puncture using a preheparinized self-filling syringe and needle, and that keeps contamination from air and bubbles to a minimum. And then you need to make sure that you put the rubber bung straight away over the end of the needle. If the sample is obtained from an art line, then you need to seal the end with a closed cap. And these samples need to be tested straight away. Otherwise, cellular metabolism occurs, which will alter the pH and alter the concentration of oxygen and carbon dioxide. They should be tested within 30 minutes in any case. If you were just testing the PaCO2, so the concentration of carbon dioxide in blood, you could just use a venous sample. You wouldn't need an arterial sample. But if you're testing oxygenation to get the best result, then you should use an arterial sample. So hypoxemia is defined as low oxygen content in arterial blood, and you might read of mild hypoxemia, moderate, severe. But we can say that moderate hypoxemia is a PaO2 of less than 80 millimeters of mercury, and a severe hypoxemia would be a PaO2 of less than 60 millimeters of mercury. And it could be due to decreased arterial concentration of oxygen, and that might be because of lung disease. Maybe there's a decreased saturation. That can be because of dysfunctional hemoglobins. So the functional hemoglobin is oxyhemoglobin, which is the oxygen carrier, but we also have dysfunctional hemoglobins, which are mostly methemoglobin and carboxyhemoglobin, and those are not oxygen carriers. Or it might be because there's a decreased hemoglobin, and that would be in your patient with anemia or hemorrhage. So, as I said at the beginning, hypoxemia is caused by disease, trauma, and anaesthesia, and it results in inadequate delivery of oxygen to tissues, resulting in hypoxia. And again, although the terms are used synonymously, there is a difference. Hypoxia is decreased oxygen at the tissue level, whereas hypoxemia is decreased oxygen in arterial blood. So when we get hypoxemic, then there's increased heart rate, increased respiratory rate, and an increased respiratory effort. And these are compensatory mechanisms to allow for decreased oxygen availability. So why does hypoxemia occur? Well, we can mainly put it into one of these five categories, and not all of them will respond to oxygen therapy. So it might be a low fraction of inspired oxygen. That could be something like hypopnea, so an animal that's got shallow respirations. Maybe it's got muscle weakness or pleural disease. That should have a good response to oxygen therapy. There may be alveolar hypoventilation, so that would be lung disease, and that also should show a good response to oxygen therapy. Diffusion impairment is where oxygen transport across the pulmonary membrane is impaired. So you might see that in pneumonia, inflammation, lungs which are fibrosis, and again, that should respond to oxygen therapy. VQ mismatch is ventilation perfusion mismatch. So this is where there is ventilation but no perfusion, or vice versa. And this is seen in pulmonary disease, also in obesity, especially in obesity where the alveoli are ventilated, but because there's compression from adjacent vessels or atelectasis, then there's no blood supply, so there's no perfusion, and therefore there's no gas exchange. And then the last one is shunt. Shunt is just where blood is literally shunted from one area to another without undergoing gaseous exchange. So here we could have an intra or an extra pulmonary shunt. So it might be that blood is shunted from the right to the left side of the heart without taking part in gas exchange because it doesn't go via the lungs. So that would be something like a patent ductus arteriosus or a ventricular septal defect. Or you can have an intrapulmonary shunt where the blood passes through the lungs without undergoing gas exchange. So if you've got pulmonary edema or acute respiratory distress syndrome. Really, shunt is an extreme degree of VQ mismatch, and often it will only be a poor response to oxygen therapy, if any response. We can't rely on pink mucous membranes to tell us that our patients are oxygenating sufficiently, and cyanosis is a late sign of hypoxemia, so it doesn't occur always until we've got a PaO2 of 60 millimetres of mercury, and this is an SpO2 of only 90%. In addition, we've got difficulties in actual visual assessment, and that might be because the lighting is poor, or maybe the fluorescent lighting is used. Sometimes the membranes are pigmented, so you can't really see what's pink. Anemic patients, which we'll talk about in a minute, or there may be peripheral vasoconstriction, and this is seen if you've given an alpha-2 agonist drug. So any animal that's had medetomidine or dexmedetomidine, that's Domitor or Dexdomitor, they will show peripheral vasoconstriction and your pulse oximeter will not be able to pick up the signal. In anemic patients, they may have inadequate hemoglobin, and that means that there's going to be insufficient transport of oxygen. And it may be that there is an increase in the dysfunctional hemoglobins, the methemoglobin, carboxyhemoglobin, and that will make the situation worse. But if all the hemoglobin molecules that exist are fully saturated with oxygen, then the SpO2 will not be negatively affected. In other words, what I'm saying here is that you can get a good SpO2 reading in anemia. If hemoglobin is not functioning, then what we think of as normal oxygen supplementation, so that's all the methods that we use to give it, is going to be of little benefit. However, hyperbaric oxygen has shown to be useful in this situation. So you might have read about HBOT, which is hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And that is giving 100% oxygen at higher than atmospheric pressure in an enclosed chamber. And this means that oxygen is absorbed by all the body fluids, all the cells and tissues, even those which are blocked or have got reduced blood flow. Anatomical differences and diseases can also affect oxygenation. So here we've got two larynxes. These are photos are both taken during normal intubation. So here on the left is a Labrador, and you can see he's got a nice big airway. Here we're going to get a size 11 or maybe a 12 ET tube in here. And over here, oh dear me, that's really bad. This is a bulldog, a young bulldog with BOAS. BOAS is brachycephalic obstructive airway syndrome, and you can see there the size of the trachea is just tiny. It didn't really move much. Normally you wait for them to breathe in, breathe out, and then you pop your ET tube in when it's at its largest. This size did not really move, and so you can see that they really love having their airway and they're loath to give it up. This is the bulldog. Obviously, you can see here he's conscious, he's being wheeled back towards, he's got his ET tube in. They're fine to be left in for as long as they need, really, as long as you are there constantly monitoring them. This guy had such bad malformation of his jaws that actually he wasn't going to be able to do anything bad to his tube. And we had to sort of physically part it from him because he just wanted to hang on to it forever. And then you may have diseased lower airways. So again, on the left, these are both CT images. This is a normal chest, so these are normal lungs. And then over here, we've got diseased lungs. These lungs are full of metastatic secondary tumours. So these are obviously going to play a part in oxygenation. There are many situations where oxygen supplementation is beneficial. So hypovolemia, hemorrhage, if there's decreased cardiac output, pre-oxygenation before general anaesthesia, any brachycephalic animal, and it doesn't have to be just dogs. We do see brachycephalic cats, British shorthairs and Persians, and also brachycephalic rabbits now. Quite severe brachycephaly is seen in certain breeds of rabbits. Some of the lops and the lionhead rabbits are brachycephalic. Anything with airway disease. So there are lots of situations where oxygen is going to be a good thing to do. Oxygen supplementation is always needed for dyspneic patients. And it may be that if you've got an upper airway obstruction, then an invasive technique such as tracheostomy or tracheal intubation is needed. So what are the goals of oxygen therapy? Well, it kind of depends on the reason why you're giving oxygen and what you hope to achieve. They include correction of alveolar or tissue hypoxia. You may be trying to treat or hopefully reverse hypoxemia. Increase the functional residual capacity in the lungs. Increase the amount of oxygen that's bound to hemoglobin in arterial blood. To decrease cardiac workload and obviously to help respiration. And dyspneic patients often show some degree of orthopnea, so that's where they stand or maybe they lie in sternal recumbency with their elbows abducted. And the reason they do that is it minimises compression of the chest wall. And these patients really need a hands-off approach, so minimal restraint, otherwise they get stressed and that increases their workload. But we can give too much oxygen and we can get oxygen toxicity. So the toxic metabolites of oxygen are things like superoxide molecules, free radicals, hydrogen peroxide, and these are called reactive oxygen species. And they will cause inflammatory lung disease and pulmonary edema. Now, there are lots of controversial figures in different texts that tell you you shouldn't give so much oxygen for so much time. And it goes from 100% oxygen shouldn't be given for more than 12 hours. Some texts say 50% shouldn't be given for more than 12 hours. Others say 60% for 18 to 24 hours. So it's difficult to actually put a figure and a time on this. But the general consensus is that a maximum concentration of 40% is used for long-term oxygen therapy. And I would say long-term is probably more than 12 hours. A Venturi valve is just a method of altering the concentration of oxygen. And this is the Venturi effect, is where gas or liquid is forced through a constriction, and that will lead to alterations in flow and pressure. So generally you get increased flow but decreased pressure, and that's the Venturi effect. It's the same thing as if you're washing your car, if you do wash your car, with a hose, and you put your thumb over the end of the hose, so you make a narrower constriction and you alter the pressure at which the water comes out. Now, you can get these Venturi valves, and they are supplied with certain brands of oxygen cages on oxygen baskets, and they're color coded and they have different size holes in them, and that denotes a different concentration of oxygen. The larger the holes, the lower the concentration, because the holes allow air to mix with oxygen. So they go, ignore the one on the extreme left, so they go from blue, which is 24%, the white with the holes, 28%, yellow is 35%, red is 40%, and green is 60%. And you can see that the hole in the green valve is actually very small. And then this one here is the blank valve. So this one has got no holes in it at all. And so that gives 100% oxygen. We should also humidify oxygen if we're going to be giving it for more than a few hours, because that prevents the airways from drying out, prevents impaired clearance of mucus, and because it prevents the airways drying out, it will decrease the risk of humidification. Sorry, decrease the risk of infection. Humidification is just saturation with water vapor. And you can get a proprietary humidifier, which are very cheap nowadays. Or if you haven't got a machine to put your humidifier on, you can make a homemade humidifier. So this is something that I made, well, my husband made actually some years ago, and it's just using a couple of Ayers T pieces. So we just cut off the long arm of the Ayers T piece and a really cheap Poundland container. So out of shot, we've got an anaesthetic machine and the Ayers T piece just attached to the common gas outlet as normal. And then this one goes through the lid, and now he has welded it on, but you can just make a hole and put it through. And then there's a plastic pipe here which goes below the level of water. Now we're using distilled water. The recommendation is to use sterile water, but many people use distilled water. And so oxygen is bubbled through and it goes right down into the water. And then here you have a tube which is not immersed in the water, and another attachment, and then another bit of an Ayers T piece which goes to your animal. So in this case, it's just going into an incubator. And so the humidified oxygen collects above the water and it's delivered to the patient. So that's a really cheap, easy way of humidifying oxygen if you don't have a machine, but it maybe you've got an incubator or a cage that you can pop your animal into. And something else to consider is nebulization. This is just delivering humidified air as an aerosol preparation. So you get rapid absorption as a fine mist or spray. And this will humidify and moisten the airways and moisten respiratory tract secretions. And it's especially useful for patients with aspiration pneumonia or for those with tracheostomy tubes. Generally, animals don't mind nebulization at all, and in fact, they usually quite enjoy it, so it's not a stressful thing. There are two machines here. This one is just a nebulizer similar to that which you may have if you're asthmatic, so it's like a human nebulizer with a little mask. And in here, we've got some sterile water or sterile saline, and the animal's breathing it in as a vapor. This one over here is a slightly different machine. This is the end. The saline or water goes into a bubble chamber, which you can't see because it's underneath the nurse's hand, and then it's just attached from machine. And the spray comes out, and you just hold it near the patient's nose. And often, nebulization is followed with coupage. An oxygen concentrator, it's just a source of oxygen as an alternative to an oxygen cylinder or an anaesthetic machine and circuit. So it runs on electricity, so you only need a power source, and it's a method of recycling room air. And the air is compressed and filtered and concentrated, and room air is roughly 79% nitrogen and 21% oxygen, roughly. There is obviously inert gases. So majority of it is nitrogen, and the nitrogen molecules are just really spat out back to the atmosphere, and the oxygen molecules are concentrated into a chamber. So these are portable units, so they're very useful as bedside oxygen sources. And there are lots of different types on the market nowadays. So you'll have your on-off switch. They can be quite noisy. That's maybe a downside. And then here's your humidifier. So in here's your sterile or distilled water. This is the little nozzle where you attach the tube that's going to take the oxygen to the patient. And then here's your fresh gas flow. And then the one on the right-hand side is just really a different a different model. So oxygen can be administered in many ways, which can broadly be categorized into non-invasive or invasive. Some, I suppose, we could say are minimally invasive. The true invasive methods, a tracheostomy, which I have covered, an endotracheal intubation, and use of a supraglottic airway device such as V-gel, which I haven't covered. And there are many ways of giving oxygen. You need to choose the best method for each individual patient, and various factors need to be considered, such as the size and the temperament of the patient, the breed, brachycephalic conformations. It's really impossible to insert nasal oxygen catheters because of the short nose to eye distance. The condition that the patient's in, why does it need oxygen? How long does it need oxygen for? And what equipment have you got available to use? So we're going to run through the main techniques that are used by all of us in practice. Flow-by is probably the easiest. This will increase the fraction of inspired oxygen from 21% in the atmospheric air to maybe only as much as 25%, or you could get up to 40% if you use a flow rate of 2 to 3 liters per minute and hold the end of the oxygen source within a couple of centimeters of the nostrils. So it's a very easy method. It's probably the least stressful method. You don't need any special equipment. You just need a normal circuit, but you can only use it for short-term use, and it's not economical. Oxygen delivered by mask will maybe increase the concentration up to 50 or maybe 60% if you use a mask with a diaphragm and it's quite tight fitting. However, if it's tight fitting, that may be stressful to the animal, and then that's going to be counterproductive because if the animal struggles whilst you're trying to hold the mask on its face, then it increases its metabolic activity, which means it has increased oxygen requirements. And rebreathing is possible, maybe if the mask is too tight or if the fresh gas flow is set too low. Nasal prongs, they're easy to use, they're easy to place. You'll probably get a similar concentration of oxygen as if you were using flow-by. They're cheap, but they may cause stress, and you can't use them if there's increased intracranial pressure or increased intraocular pressure. So we have to avoid them in animals with head trauma. And they can be easily dislodged. They are very easily dislodged in brachycephalic patients and also in cats. These are human prongs, and they come in three sizes. There's infant, which we will use for animals under about 5 kilograms, and then there's pediatric, which we use for animals over 5 kilograms. And then there is an adult size, but I think we probably only use the two sizes. So here we've got on the left, we've got the prongs, which are for a medium or large dog, and then on the right, a very small dog or a cat. So for those of you that aren't familiar, these are the prongs, then they go into a sort of Y-shaped arms, and then you've got a little toggle here, which is to tighten behind the ears, and then it attaches to the tube that you are going to use to connect between your patient and your source of oxygen. Over here, it's exactly the same, but the tube is white. It might help to keep in place to make a nose band. So if you just put a bit of tape between above the prongs on the Y arms, as we've done here, so you just literally between the two arms, but it doesn't go on the patient's face. It's not stuck down to its nose. That might help keep them in place. And the other thing that we do is to Vaseline the nose quite regularly so it doesn't dry out. And you do need to make sure you avoid the eyes because obviously that would be irritating for the patient. Nasal catheters can give quite a high concentration of oxygen, and you may achieve, if you use bilateral catheters, as in this dog here, you may achieve an increase of up to 80%. So nasal catheters would be placed for long-term oxygen therapy. If you use one catheter at a fresh gas flow of 100 mils per kilo per minute, then you can achieve an FiO2 of 60%. And if you use two catheters with a fresh gas flow of 200 mils per kilo per minute, you can achieve up to 80%. But that high fresh gas flow may cause sneezing and discomfort, and it will depend on the size catheter that you use. They can be placed in conscious patients, or it may be that you need a bit of sedation. Using local anaesthetic instilled into the nose will help. And if you've got lidocaine lubricating jelly, that's also a good thing to use. However, the patient may not tolerate them. It's difficult in brachycephalics. To be honest, it's impossible in brachycephalics. And again, as with the prongs, they can't be used in any patient with head trauma, increased intracranial pressure, anything with nasal pathology. And there is disadvantage of nasal oxygen, whether it's by prongs or a catheter. And you can see the dog here is mouth breathing. So if there's any mouth breathing or any panting, then there's increased air mixing in the pharynx, and that will lead to a reduced effective concentration of oxygen. An oxygen hood or an oxygen collar is easy to make. You might achieve a concentration of 30 or 40%. So you don't need any special equipment, you just need a Buster collar and some cling film. And you've just popped the Buster collar on, wrap the front with cling film. You do need to leave an opening to allow the carbon dioxide to escape. And just pop the tube away from your oxygen source, and that might be from an oxygen concentrator or it might be just from an anaesthetic circuit. Just pop that through the back of the neck. So you've got good observation of the patient. If you fill the hood with oxygen first, then you're likely to achieve your concentration of 40%. However, any Elizabethan collar can cause stress to the animal, so that's a downside. And there will be a build-up of heat, carbon dioxide, and water inside the hood, so you must make sure that there is a vent. It's possible that they will rebreathe, and it is possible that they'll get a secondary hypothermia. Secondary hypothermia is hypothermia that is not due to fever. And then we have oxygen cages. Now, there are quite a few oxygen cages on the market nowadays, and they're not all horrendously expensive. So with an oxygen cage, you can obviously achieve an concentration of 100%. They're low stress because the animal's in a cage. It does take a long time to achieve a high oxygen concentration, and that concentration will fall rapidly when the door is opened. So access to the patient is poor. If you open the door or open a vent, you immediately lower the concentration of oxygen, and it's going to take a long time, depending on the size of the cage, to get back up to 100%. The other thing that happens is the temperature inside the cage can rise, so it must be monitored. And it may be that you use ice packs inside the cage to help keep the temperature down. So, as I said, there are different types of cages and there are different expenses that you can pay. This will be at the top end of the market. It's got humidifier, it's got all sorts of controls, so you can vary the humidity, you can vary the concentration of oxygen. It's actually, here's the humidifier here and the controls, but this is actually one cage which can be split into two, so you could have a patient in each side. This is a cage in an ICU department in America, and this would be a very expensive type of cage. But it might be that you've just got an incubator. Some incubators, you can get secondhand incubators from many hospitals. Some don't have provision to pipe oxygen in, other than a little vent at the side where you literally put it in via a generator, as in the picture here. So this is the oxygen concentrator. That's the tube, and that there is the little vent that's taking a tube in. So it means there's not really any gap. And you can get the types of incubators with valves that allow you to regulate the concentration so the oxygen is piped straight in. You can see here we've got an ice pack in the cage to try and keep the temperature down. This is an oxygen basket which is manufactured by Burton's, and Burton's have very kindly given me this photograph to use today. So it's basically a wire cap basket which is all covered, and then here we've got oxygen which is being piped in, and it also has a CO2 vent. So this would be minimal stress. The cat's just in the basket, being oxygenated. But again, as soon as we undo the zipper, the concentration will reduce. Another downside of any oxygen cage or basket is that you can only fit small dogs or cats in. There is a type of canvas oxygen cage that comes with Venturi valves, which are marketed for medium and large dogs, but you do have to be very careful about the temperature rise. The other thing that you can do now is you can get an oxygen cage door, and this will convert any kennel into an oxygen chamber. Most of them have got a humidifier, nebulizer, many have got an ice tray, and a thermometer and a hygrometer. A hygrometer is to measure humidity, and also a CO2 vent. So you can see here the temperature inside this cage is 24.3, so it's quite high. It's getting hot in there, and we've got 37% humidity. And many of them will have an inbuilt regulator Venturi valve, which is just here. I don't think you can see it very well, but it's on the collar of the humidifier. You just turn the regulator to select the concentration of oxygen that you want to be delivered. So these cage doors are made really for many sizes and types of kennels. And then going on to the invasive methods, if you've got a real emergency situation, an upper airway obstruction, then you can use transtracheal oxygen. So you put a long IV catheter, something like a 14 to 18 gauge, placed through the skin straight into the trachea below the obstruction. And if you have time, you can use a bit of local anaesthetic first, and then just attach that to your source of oxygen. Deliver oxygen at a rate of 50 to 150 mils per kilo per minute. You can achieve a concentration of 40 to 60% in this way, but this transtracheal administration would be really a first aid process, and it is a short-term measure only. A temporary tracheostomy is one that bypasses the upper airway, so again, it would be for upper airway obstruction. And you can get various types of tracheostomy tubes. They can have single or double lumen, and they can be cuffed or uncuffed. If you were using a cuff tube, you'd only inflate the cuff for IPPV, and then you should have a high volume, low pressure cuff to decrease the risk of tracheal necrosis. Single or double lumen tubes. If you've got a single lumen tube, then the tube needs to be removed and a new one replaced every time of cleaning. If you've got a double lumen tube, then there's an inner cannula and that's removed for cleaning and a new cannula is placed. The complications, though, are tracheal stenosis, so narrowing or necrosis. You can get obstruction, especially cats. Cats produce thicker mucus, and tracheostomy tubes in cats are very high maintenance. And it may be if the end of your tube is not attached to a source of oxygen because it doesn't need to be and it's left open, then you do need 100% 24/7 monitoring because obstruction with bedding or skin folds can occur. Aspiration pneumonia can occur. It's possible that vagal stimulation might happen during cleaning, so you might get a sudden and dramatic decrease in the heart rate. Maybe sometimes they become dislodged, and in that case you would get subcut emphysema. So tracheostomy tubes are great as first aid procedure or to provide a temporary airway, but not for long term, and they are high maintenance. So here we've got a double lumen cuffed tracheostomy tube, and it's a little bit like Russian doll. So this is the outer cannula. Here's the pilot balloon. So you inflate down here with your syringe in the same way you'd inflate an ET tube, and this is the cuff that inflates. And then this is the inner cannula. So this one fits inside that one. And this is the obturator, which is just used during placement because it's got a solid end. So this goes inside that one for placement. And then as soon as it's placed, the obturator is removed. Your tracheostomy might be a normal planned procedure. So you might know that you need to place a tracheostomy tube. As this case here, the patient is clipped, it's been surgically prepared, and it's all done in a calm, planned manner. This is oxygen being delivered via an anesthetic circuit. So this is the HME, the humidity and moisture exchanger. Or it may be that you need to do an emergency tracheostomy, in which case there's no time for clipping, there's no time for prepping. It literally is slash and place your tube. And of course, this one is a Westie, so you can see the amount of mess that is involved, but there simply isn't time to actually clip the dog. And then just before I finish, just want to talk a little bit about neonatal hypoxia. Neonatal hypoxia is usually due to effects of anesthetic drugs, so for a bitch that's had a cesarean section, but obviously it can occur in any neonate. And it causes bradycardia and weak respiratory drive. In addition to that, hypothermia results in tissue hypoxia, amongst other things. And 50% of neonatal deaths are due to hypoxia and also hypothermia. And these deaths occur within 3 days of birth. So you can help these animals if you use a very small face mask. Now, puppies and kittens have got quite wide noses, so you need to use the short fat mask and very, very gentle IPPV that can help oxygenate the lungs. It's written up that you can try a 12 to 16 gauge IV catheter, obviously without the stylet, and use that as an endotracheal tube. I don't know how successful that would be. But sometimes you see these animals which have been born and they appear to be breathing, but whether they're actually exchanging gas, we don't know, because if they're cold or they have weak respiratory drive, then their ventilations won't be successful. So it's worth considering next time you're doing a cesarean section. So there are many occasions when it's beneficial to administer supplemental oxygen and many ways of administering oxygen, and you don't necessarily need the fancy equipment, and even long-term oxygen administration is now quite affordable. But don't forget time and patience. Spend time with your patients to help them receive the oxygen that in turn will help make their lives better. Thank you very much for listening today. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them now.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Denise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.